Then followed talk such as would have made the most shameless blush. He ordered me to stand up before him. I obeyed. "I command you," said he, "to tell me whether the father of your child is white or black." I hesitated. "Answer me this instant," he exclaimed. I did answer. He sprang upon me like a wolf and grabbed my arm as if he would have broken it. "Do you love him?" said he in a hissing tone. "I am thankful that I do not despise him," I replied. He raised his hand to strike me, but it fell again. I don't know what arrested the blow. He sat down with lips tightly compressed. At last he spoke. "I came here," said he, "to make you a friendly proposition, but your ingratitude chafes me beyond endurance. You turn aside all my good intentions towards you. I don't know what it is that keeps me from killing you." Again he rose as if he had a mind to strike me. But he resumed, "On one condition I will forgive your insolence and crime. You must henceforth have no communication of any kind with the father of your child. You must not ask anything from him or receive anything from him. I will take care of you and your child. You had better promise this at once and not wait till you are deserted by him." Page 77. "This is the last act of mercy I shall show towards you." I said something about being unwilling to have my child supported by a man who had cursed it and me also. He rejoined that a woman who had sunk to my level had no right to expect anything else. He asked for the last time, would I accept his kindness? I answered that I would not. "Very well," said he, "then take the consequences of your wayward course. Never look to me for help. You are my slave, and shall always be my slave. I will never sell you. That you may depend upon." Hope died away in my heart as he closed the door after him. I had calculated that in his rage he would sell me to a slave trader, and I knew the father of my child was on the watch to buy me. About this time my Uncle Philip was expected to return from a voyage. The day before his departure I had officiated as bridesmaid to a young friend. My heart was then ill at ease, but my smiling countenance did not betray it. Only a year had passed, but what fearful changes it had wrought. My heart had grown gray in misery. Lives that flash in sunshine and lives that are born in tears receive their hue from circumstances. None of us know what a year may bring forth. I felt no joy when they told me my uncle had come. He wanted to see me, though he knew what had happened. I shrank from him at first, but at last consented that he should come to my room. He received me as he always had done. Oh, how my heart smote me when I felt his tears on my burning cheeks. The words of my grandmother came to my mind. "Perhaps your mother and father are taken from the evil days to come." My disappointed heart could now praise God that it was so. But why, thought I, did my relatives ever cherish hopes for me? What was there to save me from the usual fate of slave girls? Many more beautiful and more intelligent than I had experienced a similar fate, or a far worse one. How could they hope that I should escape? My uncle's stay was short, and I was not sorry for it. I was too ill in mind and body to enjoy my friends as I had done. For some weeks I was unable to leave my bed. Page 78. I could not have any doctor but my master, and I would not have him sent for. At last, alarmed by my increasing illness, they sent for him. I was very weak and nervous, and as soon as he entered the room I began to scream. They told him my state was very critical. He had no wish to hasten me out of the world, and he withdrew. When my babe was born, they said it was premature. It weighed only 4 pounds, but God let it live. I heard the doctor say I could not survive till morning. I had often prayed for death, but now I did not want to die, unless my child could die too. Many weeks passed before I was able to leave my bed. I was a mere wreck of my former self. For a year there was scarcely a day when I was free from chills and fever. My babe also was sickly. His little limbs were often racked with pain. Dr. Flint continued his visits to look after my health, and he did not fail to remind me that my child was an addition to his stock of slaves. I felt too feeble to dispute with him, and listened to his remarks in silence. His visits were less frequent, but his busy spirit could not remain quiet. He employed my brother in his office, and he was made the medium of frequent notes and messages to me. William was a bright lad and of much use to the doctor. He had learned to put up medicines, to leech, cup, and bleed. He had taught himself to read and spell. I was proud of my brother, and the old doctor suspected as much. One day, when I had not seen him for several weeks, I heard his steps approaching the door. I dreaded the encounter and hid myself. He inquired for me, of course, but I was nowhere to be found. He went to his office and dispatched William with a note. The color mounted to my brother's face when he gave it to me, and he said, "Don't you hate me, Linda, for bringing you these things?" I told him I could not blame him. He was a slave and obliged to obey his master's will. The note ordered me to come to his office. I went. He demanded to know where I was when he called. I told him I was at home. He flew into a passion and said he knew better. Then he launched out upon his usual themes, my crimes against him and my ingratitude for his forbearance. The laws were laid down to me anew, and I was dismissed. Page 79. I felt humiliated that my brother should stand by and listen to such language as would be addressed only to a slave. Poor boy, he was powerless to defend me, but I saw the tears, which he vainly strove to keep back. This manifestation of feeling irritated the doctor. William could do nothing to please him. One morning he did not arrive at the office so early as usual, and that circumstance afforded his master an opportunity to vent his spleen. He was put in jail. The next day my brother sent a trader to the doctor with a request to be sold. His master was greatly incensed at what he called his insolence. He said he had put him there to reflect upon his bad conduct, and he certainly was not giving any evidence of repentance. For 2 days he harassed himself to find somebody to do his office work, but everything went wrong without William. He was released and ordered to take his old stand, with many threats, if he was not careful about his future behavior. As the months passed on, my boy improved in health. When he was a year old, they called him beautiful. The little vine was taking deep root in my existence, though its clinging fondness excited a mixture of love and pain. When I was most sorely oppressed, I found a solace in his smiles. I loved to watch his infant slumbers, but always there was a dark cloud over my enjoyment. I could never forget that he was a slave. Sometimes I wished that he might die in infancy. God tried me. My darling became very ill. The bright eyes grew dull, and the little feet and hands were so icy cold that I thought death had already touched them. I had prayed for his death, but never so earnestly as I now prayed for his life, and my prayer was heard. Alas, what mockery it is for a slave mother to try to pray back her dying child to life. Death is better than slavery. It was a sad thought that I had no name to give my child. His father caressed him and treated him kindly whenever he had a chance to see him. He was not unwilling that he should bear his name, but he had no legal claim to it, and if I had bestowed it upon him, my master would have regarded it as a new crime, a new piece of insolence, and would perhaps revenge it on the boy. Oh, the serpent of slavery has many and poisonous fangs. Page 80 is blank. Page 81. Starting Chapter 12, Fear of Insurrection. Not far from this time, Nat Turner's insurrection broke out, and the news threw our town into great commotion. Strange that they should be alarmed when their slaves were so contented and happy, but so it was. It was always the custom to have a muster every year. On that occasion, every white man shouldered his musket. The citizens and the so-called country gentlemen wore military uniforms. The poor whites took their places in the ranks in everyday dress, some without shoes, some without hats. This grand occasion had already passed, and when the slaves were told there was to be another muster, they were surprised and rejoiced. Poor creatures, they thought it was going to be a holiday. I was informed of the true state of affairs and imparted it to the few I could trust. Most gladly would I have proclaimed it to every slave, but I dared not. All could not be relied on. Mighty is the power of the torturing lash. By sunrise, people were pouring in from every quarter within 20 miles of the town. I knew the houses were to be searched, and I expected it would be done by country bullies and the poor whites. I knew nothing annoyed them so much as to see colored people living in comfort and respectability, so I made arrangements for them with especial care. I arranged everything in my grandmother's house as neatly as possible. I put white quilts on the beds and decorated some of the rooms with flowers. When all was arranged, I sat down at the window to watch. Far as my eye could reach, it rested on a motley crowd of soldiers. Drums and fifes were discoursing martial music. The men were divided into companies of 16, each headed by a captain. Page 82. Orders were given, and the wild scouts rushed in every direction, wherever a colored face was to be found. It was a grand opportunity for the low whites, who had no Negroes of their own, to scourge. They exulted in such a chance to exercise a little brief authority and show their subserviency to the slaveholders, not reflecting that the power which was trampled on the colored people also kept themselves in poverty, ignorance, and moral degradation. Those who never witnessed such scenes can hardly believe what I know was inflicted at this time on innocent men, women, and children, against whom there was not the slightest ground for suspicion. Colored people and slaves who lived in remote parts of the town suffered in an especial manner. In some cases, the searchers scattered powder and shot among their clothes, and then sent other parties to find them and bring them forward as proof that they were plotting insurrection. Everywhere, men, women, and children were whipped till the blood stood in puddles at their feet. Some received 500 lashes. Others were tied hands and feet and tortured with a bucking paddle, which blisters the skin terribly. The dwellings of the colored people, unless they happened to be protected by some influential white person who was nigh at hand, were robbed of clothing and everything else the marauders thought worth carrying away. All day long these unfeeling wretches went round like a troop of demons, terrifying and tormenting the helpless. At night they formed themselves into patrol bands and went wherever they chose among the colored people, acting out their brutal will. Many women hid themselves in woods and swamps to keep out of their way. If any of the husbands or fathers told of these outrages, they were tied up to the public whipping post and cruelly scourged for telling lies about white men. The consternation was universal. No two people that had the slightest tinge of color in their faces dared to be seen talking together. I entertained no positive fears about our household, because we were in the midst of white families who would protect us. We were ready to receive the soldiers whenever they came. It was not long before we heard the tramp of feet and the sound of voices. Page 83. The door was rudely pushed open, and in they tumbled like a pack of hungry wolves. They snatched at everything within their reach. Every box, trunk, closet, and corner underwent a thorough examination. A box in one of the drawers containing some silver change was eagerly pounced upon. When I stepped forward to take it from them, one of the soldiers turned and said angrily, "What do you follow us for? Do you suppose white folks is come to steal?" I replied, "You have come to search, but you have searched that box, and I will take it if you please." At that moment I saw a white gentleman who was friendly to us, and I called to him and asked him to have the goodness to come in and stay till the search was over. He readily complied. His entrance into the house brought in the captain of the company, whose business it was to guard the outside of the house and see that none of the inmates left it. This officer was Mr. Lish, the wealthy slaveholder whom I mention in the account of neighboring planters as being notorious for his cruelty. He felt above soiling his hands with the search. He merely gave orders, and if a bit of writing was discovered, it was carried to him by his ignorant followers, who were unable to read. My grandmother had a large trunk of bedding and tablecloths. When that was opened, there was a great shout of surprise, and one exclaimed, "Where'd the damn niggers get all this sheet and table charf?" My grandmother, emboldened by the presence of our white protector, said, "You may be sure we didn't pilfer 'em from your houses." "Look here, Mammy," said a grim-looking fellow without any coat, "you seem to feel mighty grand 'cause you got all them ere fixin's. White folks oughter have 'em all." His remarks were interrupted by a chorus of voices shouting, "We's got 'em! We's got 'em! Diz her yaller gals get letters?" There was a general rush for the supposed letter, which upon examination proved to be some verses written to me by a friend. In packing away my things, I had overlooked them. Page 84. When their captain informed them of their contents, they seemed much disappointed. He inquired of me who wrote them. I told him it was one of my friends. "Can you read them?" he asked. When I told him I could, he swore and raved and tore the paper into bits. "Bring me all your letters," said he in a commanding tone. I told him I had none. "Don't be afraid," he continued in an insinuating way. "Bring them all to me. Nobody shall do you any harm." Seeing I did not move to obey him, his pleasant tone changed to oaths and threats. "Who writes to you, half-free niggers?" inquired he. I replied, "Oh, no, most of my letters are from white people. Some request me to burn them after they are read, and some I destroy without reading." An exclamation of surprise from some of the company put a stop to our conversation. Some silver spoons which ornamented an old-fashioned buffet had just been discovered. My grandmother was in the habit of preserving fruit for many ladies in the town, and of preparing suppers for parties. Consequently, she had many jars of preserves. The closet that contained these were next invaded.